thank you. These days, as most of you know, I am out of the philosophy business and into the radio business. So after a statement like that, I would automatically say, it's 10:32. My name is Leonard Peikoff. I want to welcome all of you who joined us at 10:30. And our subject today is knowledge as a unity. And then you give a brief capsule for all the people that missed what you said from 10 to 10:30. And then you speak for a few minutes and say, we'll be back right after these messages. I want to apologize for the cold. I always liked it cold, as those of you who know me for years will attest. But the radio has made me like it even colder. I do the show mostly from my home, and I set the thermometer around 66 for the show. And for the first few minutes, it's very uncomfortable. It's just like a gale blowing on me. Then I become completely oblivious of the temperature and feels absolutely comfortable. And the minute the show is over, I think, God, is it cold in here? So it's an expenditure of energy that counteracts the cold, and I've become more and more dependent on that cold to function. So if you just wear warm jackets, ski masks. Now, by way of partial compensation, we've had printed, this is in the nature of a free souvenir, not a boast, but it amounts to a boast. We've had printed, in general, business cards for the Leonard Peikoff Show. And they come in two kinds, clear and arty. And I took a little stack of each, there's maybe 40 or 50 there, up by my jacket. So if you want at intermission, if you want to keep one just as a souvenir or anything, the first 40 people to get there and grab one, that's all I have, but I just grabbed a handful. Now I want to welcome you to this new mini course on unity. In one way or another, the topic of unity runs through all four classes. Today we're going to do the base of the whole discussion, and that will have a metaphysical and an epistemological component. Metaphysically, we're going to discuss the issue that everything is interconnected, it is one universe. Epistemologically, we're going to discuss the fact that as a reflection of that in cognition, all knowledge is interconnected and interrelated, reflecting the single totality which is the universe. Now, that is where, by the way, the word university came from, which is a medieval term. They accepted the idea that the universe was interconnected, was one, and therefore when they went to study, they wanted a study which would show them the interconnections between everything which existed, and that was a university, which is a very logical, epistemological reflection of their metaphysics. Of course, the metaphysics is gone now, and what we have is what they're actually calling now the multiversity, which is the reflection that they have abandoned the whole concept of unity. That basis, with emphasis on epistemology, is going to be our subject today. And then just to look ahead so you see the structure, tomorrow we will do a major concretization of the idea that all of knowledge is a unity, by taking two subjects which on the face of it are very different from each other, history and philosophy. History studies what was, and philosophy studies, in essence, what ought to be. So on the face of it, these are two completely different subjects, and yet I'm going to argue that they are completely interdependent, that each implies the other, and that both are aspects of the single unity that we establish today. So it's going to be like a detailed example of what we're going to be discussing more generally today under the proposition all knowledge forms one unity. The third lecture, which is next Monday, is more technical, but I think it's interesting and illuminating. We're going to discuss certain cases pertaining to definition where the only way to preserve the unity of knowledge is to offer two different definitions of the same term in the same context of knowledge. In the normal case, of course, you offer a new definition in a new context, but I'm going to single out a set of philosophic terms and say that they permanently require each term of this unique subset permanently requires two different definitions, otherwise you lose the unity of knowledge. And I think some of you will find that very clarifying in regard to such questions as, is James Taggart really pursue values? Does Christianity really advocate virtues? Is logical positivism really a philosophy? Is skepticism really an epistemology? There's a whole host of questions like that that are essential to untangle, and that'll be number three. And then four is some of the moral implications of all of the unity we will have established, ending on the virtue which stresses unity. That's a little stretched, but still, it stresses unity in human nature. And the virtue which stresses that is, just call it out, integrity, the unity of mind and body. So one way or another, I get away with the title because unity is going to show up everywhere. Now, I don't say that this angle on unity is a necessary or fundamental new perspective on objectivism, but it does tie together various aspects in a somewhat new way, and I think it will help to chew and even illuminate some new material, and I think you'll see that in due course. So the justification of this orientation will have to be whether at the end of the four classes you get a sense of how to put them all together and get a unity out of the discussions on unity. And today we're going to do the base knowledge as a unity. And let's start with the fact that according to objectivism, there are two cognitive processes, each essential on every level of cognition: differentiation and integration, or taking apart and putting together, or analysis and synthesis. I want to stress at the outset that both of these are essential. Neither is possible alone, certainly not to human beings, without the other. If you merely try to make a lot of differentiations, this is not this, this is not this, there would be nowhere to go with those differentiations except staring at them, and there would be no way even to hold them past a certain point because of the Crow epistemology unless you integrated them, put them together into some kind of condensed whole. So differentiation by itself would be a dead end. And of course there would be nothing to integrate unless you had a number of differences, different units, different qualities, different examples, different whatever, that you are then uniting into a whole. So I say this at the outset, you cannot have one without the other. They're like ham and eggs or Abbott and Costello. Now, if I give you a personal confession, I put it this way because I can't entirely prove this objectively. I find one of these two processes a lot easier than the other to perform, but the other much more rewarding intellectually. Now, to me, the easiest is by far differentiation. This is not that. This person is not that person. This color is not that color. This candidate, Dole, is not this candidate, Clinton, although there. Even this formulation, A is A, is not that one. Nothing can be A and non-A at the same time and in the same respect, the law of identity and the law of contradiction. Now, I don't deny that on the higher levels of knowledge, differentiation requires skill, knowledge, reasoning. It's not all as obvious as I'm making clear. For example, to try to differentiate morally between two people may be excruciatingly difficult. But at the end, even if you've achieved it, you're left merely with the two people. And by itself, that's not enough to function. You then have to integrate one person with your concept of morality, with his past psychology, with any extenuating circumstances, with your relation and background to him, and so on. So even there, the differentiation ultimately comes into its own after a process of integration. So I look at differentiation basically as offering material to integrate and thereby unify or bring together, be able mentally to encompass in one framework and understand and explain what you've been differentiating. To me, integration is the more demanding skill of the two. You need a wide-ranging mind, the ability to see similarities across a wide field of differences, and that, of course, is a distinctively human faculty. Animals differentiate. They can see that one thing is not another, just as we do, at least on the perceptual level. But they don't even dream of integrating. So if they see two different bones, that the differences between those two stop them cold. They may like the taste of one and not the other, but they can't say, let's set aside the differences in taste and just focus on the boneness uniting them all. That would be a process of integration. And that same problem holds for modern analysts at our universities. They can see the separate bones, and in fact all their journals are devoted to all the differences between the bones, but they are opposed on principle to putting the bones together. I once submitted a paper some years ago to a modern journal in which I related Plato and Aristotle's view of the laws of logic to Kant's. And I went through some of the intermediary lesser known figures like Maunsell and Leibniz and Cudworth and so on. I had a chapter on each. And they wrote back. This to me was a minor aspect of my doctoral dissertation because I had like 8 theories of logic, and this was just, I thought, a small little bit enough for, you know, an analyst committee. And they wrote back that it was fascinating but barely graspable. They simply could not retain such a diversity, Cudworth and Leibniz and Plato, all in one, you know, picture, and that they would suggest that I take this 15-page article and make it a full volume with all the footnotes on each one, which of course would have ruined the possibility of integration because everyone has to be an intensive study of the differences, and they found the sheer act of seeing beyond the differences confusing, overwhelming, and unclear. Now that to me is a literal transcription of the animal mentality, simply able to articulate itself in language. Now where does unity come in? The end result of differentiation is two. So if I'd call this course duality, we would be spending our time, I guess, on differentiation. The end result of integration is one. Integration is making one whole out of a multiplicity of parts. Now get used to multiplicity. It's just a noun for many. Integration is the process of recognizing or achieving unity. So a course on unity is in essence a course on integration. Now I remind you again, you can't ignore differences. Otherwise it would only be one thing, and then there would be no integration. Integration presupposes a multiplicity, and all the individuals that you're uniting or integrating have their separate identities. But we're focusing on the goal of putting them together as one unity and how to achieve it. Now, all levels of knowledge, as you know, represent different levels of integration. There's the integration from sense perception to from sensation to perception. And there you integrate qualities into an entity. And the higher animals can follow us there. But they leave us when we go on to integrate entities and then later attributes, actions, and relationships into first level concepts, where our mind holds as one unit an unlimited number of different concretes. And you know, of course, the example, all the tables, past, present, and future, under the concept table, all the men, past, present, and future, are held under the concept man, and so on. And we go on, of course, to integrate concepts into higher level concepts, which is where the professoriate leaves us. And finally, we reach the broadest, most abstract concepts, which are philosophic concepts. We reach such ideas as the totality of existence, the cosmos, the universe, which neither animals nor philosophers today can conceive. Now, universe, I looked it up, and it comes from versus, which is turning. And uni, of course, is one. So I take the etymology to mean that originally it was one whole turning together. But I don't think that's too good an idea, because if it's the whole, what's it turning in relation to? So I more or less tend to think of it as all the parts turned into a single entity, to keep the idea of turned. But you can just throw out turned if you want. So in a sense, we go from unity to unity. We start with one concrete, the first thing we observe in front of our noses, whether it's a sensation of red or pain or whatever it is. And by broadening the territory and continually integrating, we end with one, which is the universe, the whole. And we have to do an enormous amount of work across a lifetime to get to the point where we literally see it and think of it as one. After the perceptual stage, integration is not automatic. You have to use your volition. It takes a skill. You have to have a method. It involves knowledge. Knowledge of where to start, how to develop, what stages to go through, where to look for unity. And here we have some invaluable leads from the first civilization to discover unity as a philosophic issue and set out consciously to find it. Which civilization, in a word, just call it out? The Greeks. Now, what was their famous formula, what they were looking for? The one in the many. And they applied that both metaphysically and epistemologically, and that is the actual source of the Western focus on unity. And that was the real key to the emergence of philosophy and science, the quest for unity. And this quest started with Thales, went on through the pre-Socratics. It reached its dead end in Anaxagoras to show you what would happen if you didn't find a unity. Anaxagoras, for various reasons, reached the conclusion that everything as a concrete is irreducible. So if you said to him, what are bananas made of? He said, banana stuff. What are tables made out of? Table stuff. Clouds, cloud stuff. People, people stuff, etc. Now that came to be called by the ridiculous term pluralism, because there's many. But the other Greeks were all, in some sense or another, monists. They denied that everything was irreducible. Monism is Greek for oneism. They were looking for the one in the many, and that quest continues to this day, and Thales is the one who started it with his primitive answer that all things are water. Now that quickly developed into the four elements, which in the sense we're here using is still a one in the many, a structure, a set, that's far reduced in quantity from the things we see around us that underlies and enables us to explain everything else. So whenever you reduce it, it doesn't mean literally necessarily one when you're on the level of physics, but it means one or a handful compared to the vast diversity of what you see, because that's the quest that the Greeks were on. So water became the four elements. That went to the modern elements. And then we went to the quest for scientific unity. reducing them to molecules and those to atoms and those to subatomic particles. And today, though particle theory is a chaos, but it's still the Greek quest. A mere handful of particles from which all the furniture of heaven and earth can be built up. And this handful, whatever these ultimate ingredients are, must have some relations to each other, and because they're part of one universe, and may very well turn out to be different forms, ultimately, of some one stuff or energy or form of being. So in a sense, Thales' quest for the one and the many may end up, in terms of physics, being actually right, even in the form that he asked it. Even though we know now that it's up to physicists and not philosophers to ask the question. And even though the answer may be two or three or seven ultimates rather than literally one. Now, Thales couldn't have known the specializations involved at his stage, but he is legitimately the father of all philosophy and all science by virtue of this one quest for unity, for the one and the many. And of course, if we trace the pattern, which I'm not going to, of the discovery of scientific laws, it is repeatedly the same quest. We try to bring all these phenomena under one formula, one principle. And then we get a series of laws and try to bring them under one deeper principle, which will explain all the lesser laws. Until finally, if it's to a unified theory, see, a theory revolving around one, from which, from a few fundamental premises, you can deduce all the laws of the total universe. So again, wherever we go on the level of the substance or the level of the behavior, it's the same quest for the one and the many. Now that is looking out at physical reality. The Greeks had the identical quest in epistemology. And here the famous seeker of the one and the many was not Thales, but the first to look for the one in the many epistemologically in regard to concepts was Socrates. Now it's hard to differentiate Socrates and Plato, but essentially it's Socrates. He was seeking the one in the many in regard to the definitions of concepts. And almost all the Platonic dialogues consist of giving us, say the Republic takes justice, and they give us one manifestation after another of justice, and then the quest is, what is justice? What is it that goes through all of these examples that makes the essence of justice? And then there's the Theaetetus on knowledge, and there's the Euthyphro on piety, and everyone takes some concept and ask, well, what is this one in the many that they all have in common? And if you know the history of philosophy, as I assume you do in some general way, this turned into the whole problem of universals, as it was called. What is the common denominator among the various concretes under a given concept? Aristotle took this epistemological quest as far as the world ever went in ancient times, by abstracting from abstractions and abstracting to more until he finally reached like what was the equivalent of Thales' water, which was, in his case, 8 or 10 basic categories, which he called them categories, the basic genera into which everything falls. So if you keep saying, what concept embraces this, and then this, and then this, the ultimate categories, he had 8 in one book, I believe, and 10 in another, and they were categories like entity, action, quality, relationship. Those were his equivalent in epistemology of the Greek elements in physics. And of course, he did the same thing with the laws governing thinking as the physicists were doing with the laws governing matter, trying to reduce every principle of thinking of logic, the science he covered and created, all the way down ultimately implicitly to the law of identity. And he really did it. Got everything down to the law of identity, which has never been surpassed as the law of logic for which all the others come. So there again was his achievement, could be regarded as the climax of the Greek attempt to find the one and the many. But leaving aside Aristotle, if we just take a quick glance at the whole history of philosophy, it's been very tragic on the issue of the one and the many. Because instead of looking for the one in the many, as the Greeks did, philosophers have in effect, since that time, adopted a lethal false alternative. Those who are pro the one and those who are pro the many. Pro the one are the people who stress the unity of the universe, the unity of knowledge, the necessity of integration and seeing connections and seeing relationships. And unfortunately, these people tend to hold that the many are unreal, unknowable, mere appearance. We have to transcend them to find the one unity. And on the other side is the people who uphold the claims of the many and say, no, that's ridiculous. Many are irreducible and are real. It's the one that's just a human construct that's unreal, that's unknowable. And of course, the two disastrous trends that took these two opposite positions on the one and the many are, with an R and an E, the rationalists and the empiricists. If you take Augustine, Spinoza, Hegel, and even Plato on this point, as the rationalists, they all believe that all is one. They'd be delighted to hear that formulation. The whole universe is interconnected. Every part necessitates the rest, and the whole necessitates every part. Now, we're leaving aside in this discussion today free will. So please don't ask me how your choices are necessitated by the nature of the universe. We're talking only metaphysically, leaving aside the man-made. But if we do that, then of course their principle that all is one, everything is interconnected, and every part necessitates the whole and vice versa, is excellent. That is a unifying grasp without which we never could have science or thought. And to them, the goal was to grasp this ultimate one and come to see how everything else flows from it or is connected to it. And the trouble was, with their program, was not the goal, but the fact that they always construed the ultimate one as something with an M, mystical. There was Plotinus' ineffable one, or Plato's form of the good, or Augustine's God, or Hegel's absolute. And when you got to the one, you always found the differences are obliterated. They're really unreal. The multiplicity is really only an illusion. So they ended up, in the name of unity, wiping out the status of this world. And if you ask them, how do you get to see that everything belongs to or flows from this one? The answer was always some kind of ineffable revelation, mystic contact with the form of the good, scientia intuitiva, which is what intuitive knowledge, which is what Spinoza called it. Or for Hegel, it was even worse because you had to go through the dialectic process till you finally reached Hegel as the ultimate one. So there's a good side, an admirable side to the rationalists, encapsulated in all is one, which is the ancient Greek mystic statement, and the true is the whole, which is Hegel's statement. These are pregnant formulations, but they were mystic formulations of real truths, namely that everything is interconnected metaphysically and that integration is essential epistemologically. But because of their mysticism, they pitted unity against identity and against Aristotelian logic. Their reasoning being, if all is one, all literally is one, then no part can really be something specific and different from something else, or it wouldn't be one. Therefore, everything has to merge at this higher level into an ineffable whole. And therefore, the many become merely unreal phenomena, mere appearance. You have to transcend this to reach the ineffable one. That's, in effect, integration without differentiation. Now, in rebellion, came the empiricists, who proudly call themselves pluralists. That's all the ancient skeptics and nominalists. And then David Hume and everything he gave birth to, the whole British American 20th century positivist analyst, Bertrand Russell, etc. And that is the ultimate disintegration of the world. One of their theories at one stage, they change all the time, was logical atomism, according to which every fact is just a fact with no connection to any other fact. And the world is just this congeries of brute, unconnected, contingent, unintelligible facts. Every proposition was a free-floating sentence. You analyze its truth or falsity without any reference to any other sentences. Every word is analyzed without reference to any other words, without reference to reality, without reference to concept formation. This whole philosophy, by calling itself analysis, you see, was deliberately setting its teeth and its face against any kind of synthesis. And it's a perfect example of the willful repudiation of integration, metaphysical or epistemological. And that manifests itself in their hatred of system. See, the rationalists all wanted system building, everything interconnected to reflect the one universe. But here we have willful, righteous disintegration. Only the many, and the more of the many, the better. It's a crusade against unity. And therefore, the essence of their thought is, and I'm using this in the technical sense, not as a derogatory term, although it happens to be that, the essence of their thought is nitpicking. In other words, further and further, pointless differentiation as an end in itself, just to see differences. I have to take a moment to tell you, when I was doing my doctoral dissertation, some of you may have heard this story, I was being interviewed by the chairman of the philosophy department at the University of Michigan, and he asked me what, in Ann Arbor, and he asked me what was my dissertation about, and I said to him, I was defending the thesis that the laws of logic are truths about reality. And he said to me, oh, you uttered a really interesting term there. I'd love to hear your analysis of it. Now, the sentence was, the laws of logic are truths about realities. I figured, wow, laws, logic, truths, reality. I mean, this just opens the door, so I'm already trying to summon up everything I could say, and which one was it going to be? Which one was he interested in? The laws of logic are truths about reality. About. And his first question is, did you read Goodman's article about? And I hadn't lost the job, and that was it. Because the thing that philosophy is for is to find 37 senses of about, to differentiate. And that's it. That is what analysis is pure differentiation. Integration they regard as sloppy, unreal, old-fashioned, and any new distinction, however minute, they greet with hosannas. Now, the real basis of this philosophically is Hume. Each sensation passes by. If you know your Humean philosophy, there are no entities. There is no causality, no link between events. There are no concepts, merely random images of sensations. That is total empiricism, total, quote, pluralism, a totally passive consciousness, and it leads to total skepticism. That's differentiation without integration. And to this day, If you go to professional philosophers and you say anything remotely to suggest that you believe that all the different aspects of the universe are interconnected, you are classified as a Hegelian, because he was the last big philosopher to do that. I had a professor, Sidney Hook, dead now, that from day one and for 10 years, despite papers and conversations, automatically regarded me as a Hegelian. And it wouldn't make any difference, because from his point of view, anybody that believed in integration was had to be a Hegelian. That's the only thing you could be other than being an analyst. Now, it's against this background that I want to get to the objectivist concept of integration and unity, because that is one of the unique features of objectivism as a philosophy. It put an end to this particular battle, just as it did to so many others. Objectivists are like the rationalists in the stress that all is one. Metaphysically, everything is interconnected. Epistemologically, everything must be interconnected. The need of integration into a totality. But non-mystically, so that we agree with the empiricists that the many are real. Not only that, we are impassioned individualists in politics. Now, the rationalists were always collectivists, because all is one. The political manifestation is that all people merge into one, and therefore multiplicity is unreal. And here we have combined into one philosophy. The whole universe is one. It's all interconnected. All our knowledge is integrated into one. And at the same time, the many are the true reality, and the individual is the unit, not the group. Now, you can see that that is a thoroughly unprecedented philosophy. And I think you can guess what is the key to the objectivist view of the one and the many here that differentiates it from the one swallowing the many or the many obliterating the one. It's a special view of the relation of consciousness to existence, which is something other than we either just absorb a unity that's out there and that floods our mind, or else we passively absorb a multiplicity that's out there and end up as human. What is the distinctive? Now, someone come to the mic and tell me. You got about 3 seconds. What is the distinctive objectivist idea or concept that's even built into the name of the philosophy? If you want a hint, that gives you the objectivist approach here. Jason.
The idea is objectivity, specifically objectivity in concepts.
Objectivity as against what other approaches?
Intrinsicism or subjectivism.
Correct. You can now resume. That's it. Perfect. This is an application of the objective as against the intrinsic or subjective. And our view here is simply as follows. The integration of data into a whole is a requirement of human epistemology. It is not a reflection of some intrinsic, undifferentiated one, or whole, or God, that is out there. It is a human need, and a human process, and a human creation, as against the rationalist. So what is really out there is all the many that we bring together epistemologically because of the Crow requirements. But we don't bring it together just by arbitrarily labeling all these different manys according to convenience. We bring it together according to actual facts, objective relationships among the many, not arbitrary whims or desires, which is the empiricist idea, that all that's real is the sundered many, and any bringing of it together is your subjective feeling. So I think the best way to say that is to say that in this type of discussion, we uphold objective unity. Unity which, in a sense, we create, but we create it by following the facts of reality. But in following those facts, we don't just passively sit back and wait for the one to enter. We process the facts in accordance with the rules flowing from the nature of our consciousness. That's the basic guideline. So all is one, and these are what seem to be paradoxical formulations, but you have to get together. All is one, but all is really many. We start with many, all the various many qualities that our senses can differentiate or separate out, and then we go on a long journey, motivated by the crow, to compress this multiplicity into more and more condensed forms so that we can hold and deal with it. And we do that by a process of measurement omission, the end of which is that we integrate everything to everything and see the relevance of everything to everything. So we come to realize, in a very meaningful sense, that true is the whole. As long as you know less, you know there's more to come that will be relevant. The parts are still real at the end, because it's our processing that unites them. But the whole we reach is not subjective, because our processing is and has to be based on the actual nature and relationships of what exists in reality. So do you get that? It's an objective approach, whereas the rationalists were intrinsicists, and so the one swallowed up the many. And the empiricists were subjectivists, and so the many swallowed up the one. Now, that is a lengthy background, but it'll give you an idea why I think this topic is so important. We've often talked about other ways in which we differentiate from empiricists and rationalists, but this is a very crucial topic, and it's from this angle that I want to discuss objectivism. In what way exactly is everything one? In such a way that keeps the unity and the multiplicity. Now, we deal with unity in epistemology and ethics in this course. Now, we have to start with unity in metaphysics, because, as I said, our cognitive processes have to be based on reality. If reality were not one interconnected totality, the quest to see it as that would be baseless, arbitrary, and doomed to failure. It would be pure fantasy. So there has to be a metaphysical basis. And in my entire life with Ayn Rand, all I got from her I put into OPAR on the issue of why is it one universe. And it's on page 123. I tore the page out and brought it with me because I couldn't carry the book. It's too heavy. So I'm going to read you that paragraph. That's everything I know on the point. And then I'll give you a little more that I know. Metaphysically, there's only one universe. This means that everything in reality is interconnected. Every entity is related in some way to the others. Each somehow affects and is affected by the others. Nothing is a completely isolated fact without causes or effects. No aspect of the total can exist ultimately apart from the total. And then the epistemological conclusion. Knowledge, therefore, which seeks to grasp reality must also be a total. Its elements must be interconnected to form a unified whole reflecting the whole, which is the universe. Now, that is either self-evident or requires a great deal of analysis. I asked Ayn Rand that several times, and she said essentially that. I can't hold her accountable for every word, but in essence, she said that. Everything, it must be related in some way to everything else. Now, relation here does not mean time and space. It certainly doesn't mean only time and space, because you can be the worst pluralist and say there's a million things. One comes later than the other, and one is to the left of the other, but that's still not an interconnection that makes a whole out of it. I think that the essence of relationship here is what kind of relationship? When we say everything is interrelated. It's not that everything is the brother of another or the niece of another. Everything is related by CNE, cause and effect, causality. Things act and interact. And physicists speak of one state of the universe as causing the next. Every change in one entity or subsystem redounds through the rest ultimately. You know the way light waves continue to travel for millions of years, interacting as they go, so that some event X million years ago is still having visual effects on us now. When we see a star for the first time, when the light finally reaches us. And I'm sure the same in some form is applicable to gravitational force and electrical force, etc. In this sense, the state of the universe, and we're talking metaphysics now, at any given moment, I was trying to get through this point, implies every concrete, again leaving aside free will. It implies that every concrete is where and as it is, and every concrete implies a causal relation, near or remote, direct or indirect, to all the rest, in other words, to the whole of reality. This is, I think, the metaphysical grounds of unity, the fact of universal interaction. And it's inherent in the concept of universe. The universe is all, the one totality that exists. Try to imagine two sundered portions with, let us say, a billion-mile gap between them and no interaction, each utterly self-contained. Well, we would have two universes separated by nothing. By non-existence, you'd have to call out a duo-verse. Now, you might ask me, how do I know that isn't the way it is? And the best argument, the only argument I know with which I agree, whether you call it rationalism or not, is Parmenides. Parmenides had a fabulous principle. He was an early Greek, very unappreciated, underappreciated early Greek. He had the greatest principle of all. What is, and what is not, and what is not can neither be nor be thought about. What is not can neither be nor be conceived. And on that basis, those of you who know him know he denied that there was any void, any vacuum, no little cluster of what is not, because he said, what is not, nothing is not something. So, what's between my hands? If there's nothing between my hands, they are touching. The universe, he said, was a plenum, P-L-E-N-U-M. In other words, it was full, solidly packed. And Ayn Rand and I used to speculate, just armchair, knowing we were speculating, what is it that's in all the places where nothing isn't? And we gave it the name little stuff. The little stuff was the ultimate ingredient that was filled all the things that today are called vacuums. Now, you don't have to believe in that. It's beyond philosophy to go any further to discuss the type of ultimate constituents. But I think you can say there's one total. Parmenides is right. There can't be a slab of what is not separating the total into two separate worlds. All aspects are part of one and all interact. And in that sense, the universe is one. The many are real. They are reality. But metaphysically, the many interact causally. They all near or remote, direct or indirect. And physically, the many may very well be forms of one or several underlying interrelated substances. Which, even if that's true, in no way affects the reality of the many. Just as in my example in Opar about energy puffs, that doesn't affect the reality of sensory qualities, the fact that they all come ultimately from energy puffs. So I say all is interconnected, but there's nothing mystical about this. Now, with this as the base, we could turn to the epistemological issue. Knowledge as interconnected. And we're going to take now a 5-minute break. Now, I was saying that our focus today is on chewing the epistemological issue. Knowledge, as my book, I even call it OPAR now, which I didn't understand at first, but everybody calls it OPAR. Knowledge, as OPAR points out, is inherently relational. It's not just gazing at data, but processing it, establishing relations, partly differentiating, but mostly integrating. And these processes are metaphysically grounded because everything in reality, the concretes are different and the total is interrelated. Today we want to focus on the integrating side of it. We want to concretize the fact that every item of knowledge is interrelated. And this is a valuable mental exercise if you can do it. It will literally stretch your mind to see connections where you just simply never imagined any before. It will bring you ever clearer to a universe, one whole. And your ideal as thinkers should be that the universe is with you at all times. That whatever you're thinking about, it has enough links to the rest of what you know so that the whole context is there at all times. A brief historical note, my first attraction to Ayn Rand when I was a teenager was her, to me, astounding faculty of integration, which I'm sure is well known to you now. When I heard as a teenager that she was writing a novel that would integrate sex and economics, that to me was just inconceivable. I wouldn't even imagine that it would be supply and demand and then people wanted sex and provided it. It was awesome. And then the more I knew her, the more she would throw off. You know, liberals and conservatives were always mortal enemies, and to her, they were one. Rationalists and empiricists, mind and body. I always felt that she was on a mountaintop, surveying the whole, whereas other people were gazing down at a little patch on the ground in front of their nose. I always felt I had to move my head back when I was with her just to try to take in the scale of what she saw. She literally lived in a universe, and it was really real to her. The totality. And that's, I think, is the real reason why when she greeted you, she didn't usually say hi or how are you doing. She would say, how's your universe? That was not an affectation, because the broad philosophic abstractions were extremely real to her. The automatized perspective on the whole was there continuously from her constant integration. And that is the goal, I think, to work for. Now let's chew one example, at least in pattern. You know, to do it in detail would mean to traverse the totality of human knowledge, which I'm not equipped to do. No one is equipped to do. And the epistemological point is you don't have to be equipped to do it. But we're trying to show in pattern that to grasp any one item of knowledge fully implies grasping the total of human knowledge. We want to show that every item is connected to every other item. It has a relationship to everything else known, and ultimately that means to everything, because every time we discover a new thing, that will automatically be related to the other things we know until we reach omniscience, in which we know everything, assuming we do. Now, how are we going to show this? Theoretically, you could plunge in anywhere with any item of knowledge taken at random, and the same pattern would apply. But I'm going to take a real example on which I gave a class for the OGC several years ago. A student who was having trouble with integration said, I'm changing some of the details so you won't guess who the student was, just to protect privacy. He said that he had just learned that a certain plane from Los Angeles that he was supposed to meet would be 2 hours late. And he said, isn't this an item of knowledge? The plane will be 2 hours late. So I had been expecting something more broad and generalized that I could, you know, get to work and start some rationalistic deductions on. But I said, okay, yeah, that's an item of knowledge. And he was very skeptical that all is one. And he asked me, how does this presuppose or relate to the sum of human knowledge? And we had a long discussion, and it was very illuminating because there was nothing that you could leave out if you wanted to get to the meaning of and how we reached the plane. I'm not going to keep saying from Los Angeles, but just the plane is 2 hours late. And I want to lead you through some of the steps so you see the pattern. Now, the person who presented this example said, well, I can see some connections between this and other things. For instance, I had to know something about planes, or I couldn't have grasped that this plane will be 2 hours late. I had to know something about time, or I wouldn't have been able to say this plane is 2 hours late. So then I had to know something about watches or clocks and measuring time. And I guess the plane had to be delayed for some reason, so let's say it's weather. I had to know something about weather. And he said, so if this is what you mean, I can see. This simple statement, the plane is 2 hours late, presupposes a knowledge of time, certain instruments, certain means of transportation, etc. Weather, and he stopped. And he said, is that what you really mean? And I said, absolutely not. Now, if I promise not to ask you, how many of you would have thought that an analysis of that kind is adequate to illustrate the point that knowledge is all interconnected? Well, I appreciate your honesty, because that's where a beginning person would start. You take the words out of the sentence, and you take the things that they obviously imply, and that's what you had to know. But it's infinitely more than that. Infinitely more. You have to literally connect it to everything in pattern that man knows. So let's rephrase the question this way. The item of knowledge is going to be always the plane is 2 hours late. What did this item of knowledge require as a context to be grasped by a human being? How can we relate that item to the previous context that was necessary for someone to grasp it? Before they even communicated it to the student, it had to be grasped. What context was required for that to be grasped? And then what context was required for that to be grasped? And so on all the way back. In other words, the first point that you have to get, when we say all knowledge is interconnected, we do not necessarily mean in your concrete mind. It's not necessarily your personal context. To concretize this issue, you have to consider mankind as an entity gaining knowledge and passing it on, starting with sense perception. And then, of course, there's a specialization, a division of labor. People specialize in different items, and any one advanced item is part of the total fabric and makes possible the next layer of development. Although we all have to count on specialists, even the specialists have to count on specialists to hold many of the elements. The point is that the specific knowledge you wanted, the plane is 2 hours late, and that you could understand, rests on the total that has been discovered, all the connections, including many in people's minds that you don't know the person or the connection. But all of those connections were required for this one thing to be graspable by you. So there's a great part of this vast totality of which you personally will never get to know, But we know enough, if you've been to college or read newspapers, etc., to see the kind of pattern and to choose some concretes, and then you can always elaborate further as you go. But that's one thing that throws people off in the idea that all knowledge is interconnected. They think they have to be universal scholars. That is not true. What you have to do is just know the categories of knowledge that are required, and that they required, and that they required, and how it was a vast hierarchy across many centuries that made possible the plane will be 2 hours late. And if you can see that all the way back through the total of knowledge in pattern and in category, not necessarily only in your own knowledge, you'll concretize the principle that all knowledge is interconnected. Now, the last person that we know that did that in actual concrete terms, that is, took every item of knowledge in every subject that was known and interconnected it to every other, was Laud, Aristotle, whom Dante called the master of them who know. And that's a modest understatement. But the trouble is now there is just too much to be able to do it. We can do it through the use of broad abstractions, but we can't know all the concretes the way he could know every species, every star, every theorem in geometry and everything. So we do it in pattern now, but it's the same idea. So our assignment is how an item of knowledge relates to mankind's knowledge as accumulated through the centuries. Now let's plunge in anywhere. That's the only way you can ever do this. Just plunge in. How did we find out that the plane is going to be 2 hours late? We called the airline. He called the airline. And they looked at what? They turned on their computer. And they saw that this plane is delayed 2 hours. Somebody had to invent a computer. Now, if you want a different example, it doesn't make any difference. The knowledge had to have gotten from the plane to where they are. Radio and a computer, it doesn't make any difference. Somebody obviously had to program the computer and feed the data into it. How did the programmers find out? Well, somehow or other, they had to contact the plane, right? So you see already, before you could get this little obvious message, there had to be computers and some means of contacting the plane. They had to find out, let's say, from the pilot. And let's say the pilot told them, we're running into a big storm. We can't see it yet. It's too far away, but we see the pressure drop on our instrumentation. So how did the pilot know? Well, he read his instruments. He didn't see perceptually, it wasn't like Twister. he read the instruments. Now, we got already a whole chain of a pilot and a complicated mechanism reading instruments and sending messages to a system installed with computers where they program the data and connected via telephone banks and wires to around the rest of the world where you can just phone in and they say, no, it's going to be 2 hours late. How is all this possible? What does all this depend upon? Where did we get instruments, computers, airlines, telephones, etc., etc.? Now, this is where the goods are here does not apply any more than it does in economics. Obviously, it implies a whole series of manufacturers who made these things and a whole series of inventors who thought of them. And without both of those long series, you would never reach computers and telephones and airplanes. Now, you see, it's just a matter of continuously saying it. What does it depend upon? What knowledge was required? So the next step. Is it possible for men to start as barbarians, savages, and one day wake up and say, okay, today we're going to invent and manufacture some computers and airplanes. Obviously inconceivable, impossible. A huge context of knowledge is required before you could even dream of that kind of manufacturing and that kind of invention. Now, if we had time, which we really don't, I'd have you come up, that's what I had the class do, and each one say something that had to be manufactured or invented to get to this stage. And you get really an astonishing, astonishing list. I mean, metals had to be discovered before you could put them together. All the materials, all their properties, chemicals had to be discovered. The inventions that had to be discovered are truly mind-shattering. I mean, not just radar and, you know, telephones, microscopes, to get enough of the knowledge of what's going on the Earth, telescopes, so that they could get enough knowledge of finally reach gravity, clocks, printing press, so that it could all be disseminated. Ultimately, the wheel, before you can get the plane, and before that, the Stone Age axe. Otherwise, we're just, you know, like bears, you know, living in a cave. So there's just, just to rattle off without explanation, the top 500 inventions required to get from the Stone Age axe to the computer would itself be, I think, an hour just to condense that, and all of the inventors. So you have to assume all of that, because you try to find one for me which could have been isolated from the whole rest of the development, which didn't lead to anything else that led ultimately to the plane, which led ultimately to the plane being able to be predicted. Now, what made possible this mass of technology and inventions stretching back for centuries and involving, well, involving millions of people if you include the laborers? Could Thales have dreamed of the idea the plane is going to be 2 hours late? Not possible. The precondition of manufacturing and of inventions, both of which were very low in ancient Greece, was, in a word with an S, science. You could never have dreamt of all these modern inventions and technology without the development of science, specifically modern physics, all the knowledge we gain about electricity, magnetism, electrons, the chemical elements, their properties, all the laws discovered, you know, Tycho Brahe giving some data that Kepler saw patterns in, that Galileo saw patterns in, that Newton came up with his basic laws in, that led to this, that led to that. But even beyond all that, what is the major scientific integration without which we never could have had all of it? The major scientific integration that made possible the modern world and all of our technology and all of our inventions. Math and physics. For thousands of years, those were considered the way you would consider astronomy and horticulture. They had nothing to do with each other. One was the stars and one was the planets. Math was numbers and physics was the physical materials. It never entered anybody's mind to have mathematical physics until the Renaissance. And of course, without that, physicists couldn't find laws, and mathematicians were basically useless, which more or less they still are. But it was that ability to integrate math and physics, which is an integration, an actual union, which they did under the influence of what philosopher? Even though he himself never thought of it, he was the big influence at the time of the Renaissance. All things are numbers. Pythagoras. They were all Pythagoreans. So the early scientists were looking for numbers in their physical laws. So they tried to formulate them in terms of numbers. And of course, at the time, they were scoffed at. That's ridiculous. If you weren't a Pythagorean, what makes you think you're going to find numbers, you know, in bananas and stars and so on? And yet they found them. They found all these mathematical relationships, and then the calculus came along, and then suddenly it became obvious that that's the key to open the universe. And then all the manufacturing and all the technology, etc. Now, we're still on what was implied in saying the plane is 2 hours late. Did that require a knowledge of human nature? Well, some. You have to know something about physiology or anatomy, or you're not going to be able to work out a prototype of a plane that doesn't blast the body apart by changes in pressure. Does it imply any knowledge of human psychology? What? Just yell it out. Yell it out.
Fear.
Fear? Oh, fear of flying. Well, that's if the planes are equipped with movies and everything. I was thinking of something more directly. We never would have had the kind of civilizations which would be able to invent, discover science, engage in technology, if, at minimum, we didn't have some pro-value knowledge and some pro-freedom knowledge. Something about man's needs, even if it never was properly formulated, something about man needs to be left alone and needs to think. If we had only got the Egyptians, the medievals, or the 20th century mentality, we'd still be in caves and nobody would be out there inventing, discovering science, manufacturing, etc. So in a way, we have to know something about man and his needs. We need a picture of physics, of psychology, of the whole universe. And then to get that whole picture of the whole universe, what subject is that? Philosophy, which is where it all started. And philosophy is needed not just for causality, you know, to organize all the data according to scientific laws. On identity. And we have to know something about logic historically, or we couldn't think. We had to know about definitions and something about concept formation, etc. Some form of epistemology and objectivity was essential to the development of science. And how about some form of metaphysics? Causality, identity, the primacy of existence in some form. Before they carved those things out in ancient Greece, there was no possibility of going off and studying the universe. So really to grasp the initial fact, and as I say, some form of pro-life value judgments and pro-individual freedom had to be grasped as desirable, or they would have been like the medievals, they'd just go out in the desert, curse it all, and wait for union with God, or as they did in Egypt. Really to grasp the fact that the plane is 2 hours late, if you had to traverse all of the knowledge that mankind had to have to get to this fact, you would basically end up with all human knowledge in every field. Philosophy, physics, psychology, aeronautics, the totality of human knowledge, even if you personally didn't have it yourself, somebody had to have it, or you would never, the total progression would have broken, the connection wouldn't have been there, this invention couldn't have been made, this discovery couldn't have been made, this machine couldn't have been made, the whole would have been there, it would have been stopped. So we come to the conclusion, just from chewing this example in pattern only, that to grasp any part fully, any item fully, is to grasp everything necessary to lead to this knowledge. And that means to grasp in principle everything, not every concrete, but in pattern. That is my concretization of all knowledge is interconnected. Now, I want to tell you a brief story about me, as I have the choice, as I understand from Sandra, to go on here in an unlimited way, or to stop and make it questions. And I'd like to just get the moral of all this on the table before I stop. Is that okay with you? And then we can stay maybe 5 minutes later for questions. Some lectures will hopefully be a lot shorter, but this was the base of the whole thing. This is a story about how I developed on this very question of integration of knowledge. When I first wrote The Ominous Parallels, I divided it up into chapters. And the first chapter was on Hitler's metaphysics, and the second was on his epistemology. And I used to show Ayn Rand chapter one, each chapter when I finished it. And then she would comment and make corrections and changes, then I'd go on to the next. And I showed her chapter one, and she had various criticisms and so on. And I said to her, in a kind of disappointed way, I said, "You didn't realize the feat that I performed in writing this." She said, "Well, what was that?" And I said, "Well, do you realize I presented Plato, Kant, and Hegel, and I never once used the word epistemology?" And she said, "Well, so?" And I said, "Well, don't you see? I completely separated metaphysics and epistemology. It was very hard to do. But I realized, since this is a chapter on metaphysics, there must be no references to epistemology. That goes in the chapter on epistemology." So I kept all of epistemology out, and it was really hard. And she looked at me as though from another planet, you know. And she said, "But you smuggled epistemology in all over the place." And I said, "Yeah, but I never said it." Now, that was, from my college training, the idea of differentiation, you see. My idea was, if you're talking about metaphysics, that's it. It's like about. If it's talking about, you can't talk about under, because it's about. And this, I was doing metaphysics, and even though it was much grander scale than the way I was being taught in college, it was a whole subject. To me, that was absolute lines. When you write about one subject, you mustn't write about another. Partly that was the issue of the core epistemology. It was legitimate in this sense that to do a specific assignment, you have to drop the part that isn't essential. You have to differentiate and specialize your focus. Just as if you look at this table and abstract away the length of the color, you have to focus on one attribute apart from the rest. That's inherent in abstracting. But the great danger of that kind of differentiation is what? Making what you separate for purposes of analysis into something separate in reality without connections. And what is the name of that? Reification. Means literally making a thing out of what is an abstraction. And reification is a tremendous temptation to rationalists, which I was in spades. Because what you do as a rationalist is you detach a little square from the rest of reality, you find a few self-evidences within that square, and then you deduce all the rest from those self-evidences as a kind of floating chess game. Now, this is an occupational hazard of professional intellectuals. You have to slow down cognition artificially, because everything comes at you at once. And to do it methodically, you have to slow it down and break it up into questions, subjects, subdivisions, topics. And that's okay so long as you remember that you're doing it. But what happens if you're a rationalist is you slow it down and break it up and make a compartment out of it. You compartmentalize, as we say. That is, you take your form of knowledge and ascribe it to reality. That's the primacy of consciousness. You imagine that reality is a bunch of separate units that have no interconnection. So the parts that pertain to metaphysics have nothing to do with the parts that pertain to epistemology and so on. Your goal is just to separate out these squares, find the axioms, and deduce. You have a series of self-contained compartments, and that was my idea. And when Ayn Rand would say to me, it's all one, metaphysics and epistemology and ethics, you can't separate them. I used to find that very threatening because it's like, well, there's no way to stop, to separate it out, to concentrate on anything. It's disorienting. It feels like a sprawl of data. Anywhere you look, it's unmanageable. The best way to do it is just cut off this little slice beneath your nose and say, now, I'm going to do metaphysics and forget everything else. Keep it out. And then I'm going to do epistemology. And then if she say there was a connection, then my next chapter will be on the connection between the two, which unfortunately doesn't work because you've presented them in such a skewed way. You've separated them so thoroughly that you can't reconnect them. Now that is a true story. And the moral is that you can separate, but not artificially, and you must then reintegrate. And if you want me to put it to you in what I think is a helpful, although deliberately paradoxical and shocking, counter to common sense statement, I would put it to you this way. There are no branches of knowledge. There are no subjects. There is only cognition. No field is independent of any other field. Whether you're talking philosophy and physics, and next time, tomorrow, we're going to take as an example history and philosophy. The idea here is, subjects are separated out for purposes of study, exactly on the method that you separate out the attribute of an entity to concentrate and learn its area or its color or whatever. And you may find that one attribute is radically different from another, just as one subject is radically different from another, and that they use different methods and different concretes, etc. But you've got to put it back together at the end so that you're able to say, at the end, there are no attributes here. In reality, there's a thing. There's an entity. There's a table. And attributes are something that result from our specialized focus for our cognitive purpose. And in exactly that same way, you have to be able to say, subjects are merely our ways of taking the vast total of cognition and focusing on some attribute in order to specialize, but then we must reconnect it to the other attributes. Now, you know that's how knowledge started. Philosophy meant and means etymologically just Sophia, philo for Sophia, love of wisdom. And it included anybody who knew anything was thrown in there because there wasn't enough to separate out special sciences. And then one by one they set up shop on their own, but if it had been done properly, they would have always remembered that they had to stay connected to each other and to what we now call philosophy in order to remain part of one knowledge reflecting one universe. So the essential point is that the responsibility of any time that you subdivide, specialize, or differentiate is get back the total at the end. If you take a cognitive step on the level of perception, you separate out some physical attribute for special study, then you have to obliterate the disconnection. Not the distinction, but the disconnection. Reintegrate. Now with the added knowledge, back into the entity. so that at the end, perceptually, you see the entity as a whole and not just some isolated feature of it. And the same is true on the conceptual level, however advanced. You can demarcate and separate out any question, topic, field, subject, theme, proposition, word, for specialized study. But at the end of the study, you have to obliterate the disconnection, reintegrate, again with the added new information, back into the total. And on the conceptual level, that means back into the total of everything you know, your awareness of reality as such, your awareness of the interconnected one, which is the universe. And on that note, we'll bring the first of these lectures on unity to a close. Thank you. Now we have at least 10 minutes for a question period, and maybe we can go a few minutes beyond that. So do you want to just stand up just stand in a row, because I understand they need you to ask from the mic, and I'll answer from here.
Is the idea of entities or existence as individual things strictly an epistemological perspective of a universe in which metaphysically there is no separation, so that metaphysically there is not a many, and many is our perspective which enables us to grasp reality?
Okay, I would answer that question by saying a couple of things. First of all, that level of question is physics, not philosophy. I have no idea whether there is one undifferentiated totality which under some set of circumstances or conditions breaks up into many or not. Therefore, I am not in a position to say yes or no on the level you're talking about. That it is really only one, and the many is just the concretes from our perspective. But the important answer to your question is, supposing that were true, it would not entitle you to make the statement that the many are just our perspective. The important point is, if it was one undifferentiated slab, it's still true that that slab organizes and acts and structures and relates to different aspects of itself in such a way that when we open our eyes, we see all these many things. And remember, if there is only that one slab, we're made of the slab. Our senses are made of that, the little stuff or whatever it is. The world we see is made of the little stuff. And it means that the little stuff by its very nature, when it starts to interact, divides itself into perceivers and objects exactly the way we are and perceive them. So this is telling us something absolutely essential about the underlying unity, which is that the underlying unity manifests itself as a gigantic multiplicity and has to by the very nature of its unity. You see what I'm saying? So be very careful in ever saying it's true that we perceive in a certain form. And it's up to physicists, not philosophers, to specify what the form is. But I have a very good passage, if I say so myself, in Opar, dealing with this question. If everything were really energy puffs, would that show that red and green and hard and soft and rough and smooth and so on are all just subjective, just our human ways of looking at things? And I answer no, because it's still, this was Ayn Rand's answer, of course, it's still true that when those energy puffs come together as human beings and as objects, the interaction of those energy puffs are red and green and hot and cold, etc. So that everything that exists everything we perceive derives inevitably from the ultimate nature of reality. And if something derives from the ultimate nature of reality, you cannot write it off as just a human perspective. It is metaphysical. So in that sense, multiplicity is just as metaphysical as unity. Okay? Harry.
On your last subject of when you draw a little square and you work within the square, then you've got to reconnect it to the whole. Would you agree that even the work you do within the square involves an interrelating to things outside the square, so that if you do it properly within the square, you're also connecting to other topics?
Absolutely. If you stay entirely within the square, it's pure deduction then. You're not doing any induction, you're not doing any integration, you're just keeping, it's like, you know, those logical exercises where you just start with two propositions and derive a conclusion, then add another one and derive a conclusion. It's completely mechanical. If it's actually a process of cognition and you are really investigating what is going on in a given square, since that square is going to be connected to a million things, if you're looking at even what you're interested in, you're going to see or sense, oh, this would lead there, and this would lead there, outside the square, all the way through. Some integrations will be essential, and you'll make them and say, this is fascinating, I want to pursue that later. Or, now that I see this, I see much better what I was trying to do in this square from the broader perspective of this outside context. If ever you isolate, and you never find reality intruding, you know, you can just work in your little thing forever and ever. You're out of touch by that very fact. It should not be neat. It should be messy to break reality up into parts. There should always be stuff left over that's pushing to be thought about and interconnected. And that's why it was so fantastic to Ayn that I would say how proudly I left out epistemology in presenting metaphysics. She thought that was just bizarre. You know, she was on another planet and she couldn't figure out where I came from. And I thought, what's the matter with her? She doesn't see a self-evident achievement. You know, so it had that complete, but you see the answer to what you're saying. I mean, you agree with that?
Yes. I have a question about the plane being 2 hours late example that you were using. I see how virtually every field of human knowledge is at least implicit, and some far more explicitly so, like what leads up to the existence of the plane and all that. But it doesn't seem to me that every other discrete datum of human knowledge is necessarily implicit. For example, the fact that there is a Mrs. Jones in Omaha or something.
No, well, we're omitting the man-made from this insofar as we say every. It is impossible. When we say everything is interconnected, we cannot talk about concretes involving human choice except insofar as the choice leads us to metaphysical or physical principles. But if it's just, you know, for instance, I played with a rubber band today. Now, I could have or not have, and the whole development of human knowledge would remain the same. So I certainly grant you that there are a great many of the volitional things that are, we're talking about the principles of the field, which is really what we're talking about when we get to cognition. I'll go you one step further. There are many different ways to learn principles. There's nothing in physics that would say the culminating insight had to come to Newton through an apple hitting him on the head, you know, rather than a peach or an orange or something else. So, suppose apples had never been discovered. Now, I'm a little more hesitant here because apples is already a big swath of architecture, and that involves a whole bunch of minerals, and that involves, you know, fertilization and meteorology, and I do not know the interactions there, but I can see already a lot of potential for a lot of connection between apples, you know, and Newton. But leaving that out, I can imagine that any given concrete didn't take place if its equivalent did. You see? So what I'm really saying is that the principles that mankind drew and by which they integrated are the things that led to the next step and the next step and the next step. Those principles depend upon concretes, but not always, and in every case, unique concretes. Although, as I say, in many cases, I think you'd find that the concretes themselves contribute, presuppose other knowledge, so I would never make, you know, just a flat statement, well, any concrete will do. Does that answer you?
Very much. I didn't understand you. I heard your remark about the volition part, but I didn't understand the ramifications of it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, you see what, just for your information, if I could just add this, Spinoza thought that when you reach the insight into the one, you would be able to grasp in one synoptic insight not only how all the principles of the universe are interconnected, but literally the detail of every single concrete, without any issue of volition or of worrying about, you know, just abstractions versus concrete, you would be literally omniscient, not only about the principles that explain everything, but about, like, you would know this sugar packet, you would know which letter was blurred, how this one differed from it, for you, and that's why they made it mystical, you see, because the only way we can hold a totality is by abstractions. And abstractions, we omit the measurements. We can then learn the measurements of any given one, but we can't learn the totality and keep the measurements. Does that answer you? That's one reason that they made it mystical. They had no idea of omitting measurements as being a human form, and so they thought the only way you could integrate it all is either to say there are no concretes, or you get this mystic insight. Plato had the same idea of a mystic insight coming from the form of the good, where every concrete was deducible. Yes, sir. Now, we're officially 2 minutes late, so there'll be no hard feelings if you want to get up and go. But I'm going to go on for about 3 minutes more just so I can say we had a question.
Okay, one of your premises that you state is that all that makes or tell me if this is right, all that makes a fact possible is required in order to grasp that fact.
No, I wouldn't put that statement. That's a metaphysical statement.
Okay.
I would say all that makes a fact knowable is required to grasp that statement. There may be many, many, many things that make a fact possible that have not yet been dreamed of in physics, which we don't have to know this fact. This is purely epistemological. The metaphysics is only in giving us a world in which everything is interconnected. The epistemology is we only can connect within what we know, and each new piece we connect to the preceding.
So therefore, we don't have to know all the knowledge about how planes are built in order to grasp the fact that a plane is late.
No. Okay. Somebody had to know every element that was required if you drew the total cycle from the original sense perception of the caveman to the plane being late. But no one person knows it all. And not since Aristotle. Or, I don't know, I heard that Leonardo had that too, but whether his knowledge was as encyclopedic, it's physically impossible today, unless you do it through a computer. If you have a computer with, you know, where you could look up every concrete, but who would program it? I don't know, maybe Bill Gates could do that. If this is your way of telling me, I take it that you're hungry. So we are going to conclude for today, and at the same time tomorrow we're going to do philosophy and history. Why that is the same subject, even though one is concerned only with the past and one is concerned only with what ought to be. Thanks very much.